welcome to another one-off edition of the House of Comments. My name's Emma Burnell and I'm a political journalist. And I am absolutely delighted today to be joined by Deborah Mattinson, who is both the founder of the amazing opinion-forming, opinion-testing organisation Britain Thinks, but more importantly, the author of Building the Red Wall, or is it Demolishing the Red Wall? I can't recall. Sorry.
Beyond the Red Wall. Beyond the Red Wall.
Beyond the Red Wall, that's right. So one of those things you think, are you building or are you demolishing?
I was trying to kind of look beyond it and see where the future would go.
Absolutely. Now, I've read the book, and I said to Deborah before we started, and I'll say again, it's one of the most engaging political reads I've read in a really, really long time. It's not, so I very much enjoyed, say, Left Out, which is all about the insider political gossip, because I'm, you know, a geek. But this book is about real people, and it's beautifully illustrated with so many examples of people's real lives, and absolutely charmingly written. Deb, I just think
it's... Thank you so much. That's really, really kind. Thank you. Thank you.
So, obviously, the election was less than a year ago, coming up to a year. How quickly after what happened did you decide to write the book, or did you already have it in mind? Were you seeing which way the tea leaves were falling?
Oh, I wish I could answer yes to that question, that I predicted it all. And wouldn't that be just great? But sadly, no. And in some ways, that was what made me decide to write the book. And the truthful answer is that actually on election night, I got a text message from one of my kids saying, because the book I wrote before, back in 2010, after I'd been working with the Labour government for a long time, was called Talking to a Brick Wall. And one of my kids...
Which I can also highly recommend. Oh, and I think it's still very pertinent today.
Yes, well, I hope so. I think there are a lot of themes, because it is about what happens when you stop listening to voters. And if you stop listening to voters, you're in trouble. And there were a lot of themes that carried across to the two books. But one of my kids messaged me on election night and said, you know, your next book should be Talking to a Red Wall. Ha ha ha. And I thought about it and I thought, actually, that's right. Because, you know, straightforward confession here, I sort of hadn't seen this coming. At least I hadn't expected Labour to win. But I had no idea what the scale of the loss would be like, and in the Britain Thinks sweepstake that we run for elections whenever there is one, you know, I had actually got the Tory vote right, but I had I'd underestimated the scale of Labour's defeat, and I just hadn't seen this coming. And then I reflected on it and I thought that in many years of being a Labour pollster, I couldn't recall ever going and running a focus group or a poll in any of those Red Wall seats. I just hadn't done it. We had just totally taken them for granted. I mean, actually, there might have been the odd by-election, but beyond that, it just hadn't happened. And I think that, you know, so Labour, the incumbents, had taken them for granted. And the Tories hadn't bothered to go there either, because they were also assumed to be in the bag for Labour. So what was the point? And that meant that that's like 5 million people who had just been completely ignored and neglected. And boy, that's how it felt to them too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is the absolute thread running through the book, because obviously these are huge amounts of people, yeah, as varied as all people are. But the thing they seem to have in common was a real sense of grievance and resentment, and rightly so, about the difference in their lives and the lives they saw represented maybe in the media or on television of other people down south.
Absolutely. I mean, huge resentment. And in each of the places that I went to and I sort of decided rather than try and cover lots of different places to pick three constituencies and really go into them in some depth. So I went to Darlington, I went to Stoke Central, and I went to Hindburn in Lancashire, which is where Accrington is. And in each of those places, what was interesting was this incredible pride in their past. And they all had a lot to be proud of, by the way. So Darlington, you know, famous for its railways. Hindburn, Accrington developed this thing called the Norrie brick. It's iron backwards. It's the strongest brick in the world. And it was used to build the Eiffel Tower and the Empire State Building. so proud of those brickworks. Lots of people had worked there. And then, of course, Stoke has the potteries. So, but all of those are in the past. You know, somebody in Stoke said to me, all the potteries are just, you know, they're either closed down or they're little museums. Nobody actually works there and does a proper job there anymore. So there was this sense of it, all their glory was in the past. And then when they looked to the future, it was very uncertain. And you know, the young people basically either carried on living there with nothing really to do very much, perhaps, you know, working in retail, working in a cafe, working in caring jobs, but very, very low paid, often quite casual work, or they had to leave. And, you know, why should your child have to leave the place you brought it up in order to get a decent job?
Yeah, I think absolutely.
They felt very resentful.
Sorry, excuse me. I have a slight cough, but don't worry, I've been tested.
I'm not going to catch it over Zoom, I hope.
No, fair enough.
Unless it has a really interesting way of mutating.
Well, I mean, who knows with this bloody thing?
And I'm not wearing a mink coat, and neither are you, so we're fine.
No. The closest I've got is the cat, who's currently looking intently out the window. I think one of the, I mean, for me, as a Londoner, I often describe myself as one of the few Londoners who's actually from London. You know, I grew up here. I was born, I mean, my secret shame is I was born in South London. but I, you know, I'm a North London girl. I'm the kind of person who can tell the difference between a North London and a South London accent. But most of my neighbours come from somewhere else, whether that's abroad or whether that's elsewhere in the country. We are the melting pot that those kids move to. Yeah. And I try, you know, I'm a very proud Londoner. I love my city in the same way that the people in your book love their places. But it's really difficult, isn't it? Because London sometimes feels like the only place you're not allowed to love.
It's so interesting. And I think this is something, you know, this is a challenge, I think, I was going to say for all politicians, in a way it's a challenge for all of us.
Yeah.
So what, you know, what the people that I met felt, and they felt this very, 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 very strongly, was that, you know, London had taken all the tarts. You know, London had got all the prizes. London had...
And there's a very good argument for that.
Yeah. And they, you know, so if you take something like Brexit, one of their arguments was, well, I can see that people in London benefit from being in Europe, but we don't. It's a problem for us. Now, you know, you could argue the toss on that, but it's something that they felt. And, you know, perception is reality in that sense. And it's very interesting as well, if you think about where the Tories are with this. And this, you know, it's a feeling that I think Boris Johnson tapped into incredibly effectively. And maybe we should come back and talk about him, because he was definitely the catalyst that enabled people, gave people a license to vote Tory. Very, very interesting what happened there. But basically, you know, he talks about levelling up. That is interesting. Nobody I met talked about levelling up, because they don't think it is about levelling up. They don't, when you explain it to people, they don't buy the idea. They don't want levelling up. They see it as a zero-sum game, and they actually only think that their place can get better if us fat cats in London and the South are made worse off. You know, they actually feel that there needs to be a redistribution of funds rather than us all somehow gloriously rising up to match London. So, you know, it is a real, real challenge, and their resentment is very deep.
So, I mean, that's really interesting, because they voted Tory, but in many ways that's the Corbynist argument against New Labour's position, isn't it?
It is, although, you know, from Corbyn's point of view, he is seen just as much as a sort of North London middle class. I mean, they've got many grievances with Labour. One of the grievances with Labour is that it had been taken over by a bunch of middle class, snooty graduates who look down on people like them. And again, they're not wrong there. You know, I find whenever I tweet anything about the Red Wall, I tend to get a load of replies of people saying, bunch of racists, they just need educating, if only they knew the clever things I know, et cetera, et cetera, which really sums up the problem. You know, let's blame the electorate, let's make it all their fault. But, you know, there is a whole thing about, I think one thing to say, by the way, though, in Corbyn's defence, and I do think this is quite important, whilst he turbocharged the problems, right, they got much, much worse on his watch, he didn't cause them. This had been coming for a long time. And interestingly, in several of the constituencies that I went to, this was particularly true in the Northeast. There was this feeling that in a lot of those constituencies, what Labour had done was to parachute in their favourite son, you know, and it usually was a son, not a daughter, you know, who would take the seat on because it wasn't a seat you had to work, because it was a safe seat, would look south, head down to Westminster and never look back. You know, would have staff who ran a surgery, would appear here and there, you know, to events and things, but basically didn't know the constituency, didn't get to know the constituency, was not battling for them. So, you know, and I think that definitely was, you know, this was a slow car crash. It had been coming for a long time. And in that sense, the Corbynist analysis is right.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I wasn't a Corbynista. I think that's fairly well known. But I definitely felt that they had, certainly their economic analysis was more to my taste than New Labour's. It was the party management and party culture stuff that I found. So, well, and foreign policy. And I think the foreign policy stuff probably speaks to a lot of why eventually the Red Wall did reject Corbyn in particular. Because of the patriotism issue, and he was just never seen as patriotic. And these are, you know, they are both very proud of their place, but also very proud of Britain's place in the world.
Yes, it was so striking. So I think there's a really interesting thing going on here, which is that, yes, everybody I met was very connected to their local community, much more so than many of us people who live in London are, you know, would know all their neighbours. In fact, very often their life was played out within, you know, two or three streets. It's where they worked, it's where they lived, it's where they socialised, it's where their kids socialised, it's where their families lived. So very connected to the community, intensely aware, and actually often hadn't moved, you know, they'd lived there all their lives, their parents, their grandparents, etc. So there's that. But what they didn't often have was any connection with their nearest city. So, you know, what happens in Hindburn is a great example, where in Accrington, you're only 20 miles from Manchester, which is a great thriving city that has, you know, really kind of been on the up actually in recent years. But it takes an hour and 20 minutes to get there by public transport. So many of the people that I spoke to never, ever went there. Mm-hmm. One of the men that I met talked about one of his sons had moved there for work, and he was incredibly sad about that. And he felt like his son had moved to Australia. You know, it was a really big deal because he never went there. So connected to their local community, not very connected to their nearest city, but massively connected to the country as a whole, and hugely proud. And absolutely, as you say, one of their core criticisms of Labour, and particularly Labour under Corbyn, was this feeling not only that Labour wasn't patriotic, but that Labour was actually ashamed of its own past. And that was a real problem.
Now, I am an absolutely ardent feminist, and that's one of my core values. I go on and on about feminism, possibly more than I go on about socialism these days. It's funny what happens when you were a woman in your 40s.
you.
But I do, I'm becoming more and more aware that Labour's various tribes of identity, BAME, LGBT, feminism, are becoming something that is alienating people. Now, I don't want to give up arguing for women's rights, but how can I do that in a way that is connecting with people rather than alienating people? Because there's no point arguing for something in a way that puts people off.
I think there are several things going on here, actually. And in a way, what you're doing, you're slightly veering into the sort of culture wars stuff, I think. So one of the problems, and as I said already, there are many problems that they have with Labour, but one of them is the sense that Labour is preoccupied by things that they are not preoccupied with.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean to say that they think they're actually wrong. It's just that they think that they're really odd priorities and there are other things that are really worried. So there was I had a very interesting conversation with a group of men that I met in a kind of hotel I think that was in Accrington, I can't remember now, where that day, so at that, this was whilst the Labour leadership contest was going on. And I don't know if you remember, but there was a point in the Labour leadership contest where the whole issue of trans rights became quite contentious. And there was quite a big debate that went on for about a week about trans rights and were the various candidates in favour of them or not in favour of them, and et cetera, et cetera. And one of the guys that I met, and by the way, almost everybody I met without exception was very nice, very engaging, very warm, very, I mean, really decent people, right? This was not said in any way making a political point or being challenging or contentious deliberately. But he turned to me and he just was a bit bewildered by it all. And he said to me, how many trans people are there in the country? Which I'm afraid to say was a question to which I did not know the answer. So I didn't even attempt to guess it. I said, I honestly don't know. What do you think? And he said, well, fair play to them. It's fine. But, you know, I've never met one. And I don't think there are very many around here. And I just don't know why Labour keeps going on about it. Because there are lots of things around here that they could and should be going on. So it wasn't that they... Now, it's not answering your feminist question. We'll come back to that in a minute. But I think the whole culture wars thing, in a way, is more about Labour apparently focusing on things that are less important or affect fewer people than the things that were worrying them, right? So I never heard anybody be mean or unsympathetic. They had some real issues about some of the trade-offs that come with some decisions that might be made by government. But so onto the feminism thing. I would say that although I don't think that they would have described themselves this way, most of the women I met were feminists. Certainly, all of the women that I met had much harder lives than all of the men that I met, right? Almost without exception, they worked. A few of them had retired, but other than that, you know, they were all working women. Many of them were working several jobs. There was one woman that really struck in my mind that I met in the Northeast, who was working, I think, four different caring jobs, all on 0 hours, all on minimum wage. And she had one day off a week, and she spent the one day off a week caring for her elderly grandparent. And that was her life. You know, I think doing some focus groups in Hindburn, one of the women had to keep, she again had several jobs. One of her jobs was as a foster parent to a very troubled teenager with learning difficulties who she said, was it okay to keep her phone on? I normally ask people to turn them off. But she said, I really need to be in touch because he's going to call me. And he kept calling. She had to keep kind of reassuring him. And then in the end, she had to leave slightly early. They had very tough lives. To your point about feminism, I don't think that those women would have argued at all with a policy, solution to their problems, and to have a politician who understood their problems and spoke to their problems. Mm-hmm. I just don't think there'd be any debate there, actually.
No, I think that's right. I think maybe it's about having a practical, pragmatic feminism rather than academic feminism.
It's definitely that. They certainly, I don't think many of them would have been terribly interested in academic feminism. I don't think many of them, you know, on the day we're recording this, it's a couple of days after the Mary Wollstonecraft statue has gone up in, you know, I don't think that they will have picked up that or will be fretting about it particularly, or even have heard of her. And that's a bit of a shame probably, but still. They definitely have issues in their lives that they would like sorting. They wouldn't describe them as issues that are about feminism, but I think you and I would. I don't think there'd be any debate there.
No, absolutely, absolutely. So, so Labour is now really concentrated in cities. And as a city girl, I'm all right with that mostly, but as a person who believes in democracy, I'm not all right with that. One of the joys of my life is that I used to work for a local government think tank. And we used to go around the country. So I've actually got out of Westminster quite a lot, which is great.
So important.
It's so important. And, you know, we had like members who were like tiny little district councils like Blaby in Leicestershire, Sunderland, who's a big city council up in the northeast. And when you get out of London, you do hear these different stories. But what there isn't it seems to me, is a political infrastructure, particularly in the Labour Party, outside of the cities at the moment. So how would Labour go about fixing that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think certainly Labour, as I say, partly it's a function of the sense that I was describing earlier, where, you know, Labour is very much about Westminster, all politics is really. I think, you know, here's a radical thought. I think one thing you could do is try quite hard to have MPs who really are from the place. I think you could change the role of the MP and have them spending much more time in the place. I mean, goodness, we've got into voting remotely now. It's changing the way we all work because we're working remotely. I don't think my company, Britain Thinks, will ever go back to working as it did before, ever. You know, and we've just done a survey of staff, and they've all said to us that they'd quite like to be able to work flexibly. Of course, they want the office life as well. They want the creativity that comes from that. Why not change politics the way we do politics in the same way? Why not have people much more based in their local places? I think the other thing is the importance of local government. And one of the things that I felt, and it's a bit of a generalisation, and some local councils have done better than others, but very often the only connection that people had with the local Labour Party was through the council. And very often those councils were not doing a particularly good job. So, you know, if you're wondering what Labour will be like in government, having been out of government for a long time, you look at how they're doing in local government. And if they're doing well, great. If they're doing less well, well, you wonder.
Well, absolutely. And I think there's a chicken and egg thing slightly. I mean, regular listeners will not be surprised that I have strong views on local government. Yeah. I'm a local government geek. But I think there is a chicken and egg thing where local government has been so devalued and disempowered. That, of course, it then doesn't attract the kind of people that there are some fabulous council leaders, but there are also a lot of people who are just doing it in a plodding way, I suppose. And I would say that if there were to be another Labour government one day, who knows, one of the things that they should do for their own good is give away their power, because that actually then increases, as you say, the visibility of them in the community. Now, of course, that means giving power to Tory councils too, but that's okay, because that's how democracy works.
Yeah, I think it's so important. And I think, you know, that the local mayors offers an opportunity as well. I mean, you know, just a quick aside there, but, you know, in the Northeast, Ben Houchen, the elected mayor there, I think had done a lot to persuade local people that the Tories actually could make a difference locally, that they were really interested in doing things locally. And, you know, he's run very successful local campaigns, like, you know, the local airport and so on. And everybody was aware of that. He's a bit of a kind of like a political rock star locally. I think it's made a difference.
He was very derided while he was running, certainly from people down here. He was, you know, seen as someone with very little experience. But yeah, you're absolutely, and that's a part of the world I know really well. My ex-husband lived up there before we met. And it's a beautiful, beautiful part of the world, but very run down. And, you know, all of those things that you say about these towns, I mean, Darlington's part of it, isn't it? I went through Darlington to get to Saltburn. Beautiful station, but you walk around 10 minutes from the station and you do see areas of real deprivation. Considerably worse.
Absolutely. And Darlington was by some measure actually the most on the up place of the three places that I went to. It was definitely in a better state than Stoke was. Really terrible, very run down. And you know, places like Accrington, Oswald Twissel, they were, you know, you just walk past, every other building is boarded up, you know, and you can see these sort of beautiful old mills, and they're just, most of them are disused, empty. You know, these, it's a very stark reminder of what has been as well, that's just there every day for people.
Absolutely. And in so many ways, we've actually turned that around in cities, haven't we? I mean, I'm thinking of the Baltic, for example, in Newcastle, or is it possibly Gateshead, because it's the other side of the river?
Yes. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think it's something that the Labour government, to its credit, did very well, but it focused too much on the cities.
And the towns felt more and more left behind and left out.
Absolutely. And took them for granted.
Apart from having people who look like, sound like, think like, most importantly, representing and then trying to represent these places, what else would be your advice for how we can change political culture?
So I think that, I mean, this group of people have been incredibly neglected. They feel incredibly neglected. But the quite interesting thing is that they are now discovering their political power, right? And they suddenly realise, I mean, I didn't very often hear the term the Red Wall. People didn't sort of know about this phenomenon particularly. But nonetheless, they know that their places are now a focus for all politicians. And they want to be wooed. They're expecting to be wooed. I mean, you know, it's not a shoo-in for either party, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I think that, you know, the bar is set very high indeed for the Tories now. They have big expectations and they expect them to be met. And whilst they would cut Boris Johnson a bit of slack because of COVID, in the end, they nonetheless expect some of the things they feel they've been promised to actually happen. So you know, there's a clear task for them, but for Labour as well, there is an awful lot to do to persuade people that they are in touch, that they understand, that they don't look down. And that's partly about hearing those. I mean, somebody who I think did kind of test very well, as it were, they didn't know her because she, outside of Westminster circles, is not so well known, but is Angela Rayner, because she sounds much more like them. You know, she speaks the same language, she has the same sort of story, and feels like she gets it. And I think the more you can have senior politicians who have their own stories to tell, who really understand the kind of lived experience of the people they're trying to connect with, the better.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yeah, Angela is very, very good at using that biography to connect with people.
Yes.
Always been a, you know, I've seen her speak many, many times at various fundraising dinners.
Yes, and she's great. And people, you know, I think that, as I say, I haven't heard anybody spontaneously say they liked her, you know, because she wasn't well known. But when I have been in a situation where I've been able to show people a film clip, or we did a thing actually for the BBC during Britain Thinks during the election, and she spoke at it, and we had a group of swing voters, we were in crew, and their minds were blown. They were like, I didn't realize a person like that could be a politician.
Absolutely. No, and I think that comes back to something we were talking about just before, which is that authenticity thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
It really is. I'm pretending to be Angela Rayner. I'm a middle-class girl from Hackney.
Yeah.
If I tried to put it on, it wouldn't work. And if Keir Starmer tried to put it on, it wouldn't work. I mean, he does a good job with his own backstory, but it's a different backstory.
It is. I think he needs to do a better job to differentiate. One of the things I would observe, and I mean, I think there's an interesting question about why it is that Boris Johnson, you know, old Etonian, you know, who spouts Latin every 5 minutes, managed somehow to say to these people that he was on their side, but he did. And part of that answer lies in that, you know, in a way, he, Jeremy Corbyn, Keir Starmer, they're all posh blokes. They're all posh southerners, you know, who've never had to worry about whether they'd get a job or not. You know, they're all very different. And in a way, the nuance that you or I might observe between the likes of Boris Johnson and the likes of a Keir Starmer, who obviously, you know, comes from a very different, like much more kind of ordinary background, went to a state school, you know, dad was a manual worker. But the difference between them is sort of lost on a lot of voters.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And again, you can't really fake that. You can't pretend not to have had an incredibly successful career as a QC and a director of public prosecution.
Oh, and why would you want to? I think you have to, you know, fill it. Pick out the bits that from that are working for you. And I think saying I'm on the side of law and order is not at all a bad thing to say in the Red Wall, no, or indeed most other places. And actually, since that's something he spent his career doing, why not?
Yeah, and it's usually those working class communities who are most close to crime, and where crime
happens. Crime and kind of like low level antisocial behaviour. Drugs, these are huge issues in every place that I went to the point where in some of the places, you know, the centre of town was frankly a no-go area at night. You were very worried if you had teenage kids about them going out. Most of the people I spoke to said that they didn't really, you know, sort of dare to go out in the evenings, didn't want to go out to a pub, particularly the women, you know, just felt these were places they wouldn't want to go to. So absolutely, those sorts of things resonate.
Absolutely. So I can't let you go without asking the obvious question of the moment, which is, how do you think COVID is affecting all of this? Do you think it's having an effect?
Yeah, it's so interesting, to be honest. And you'll have seen this because you've read the book, but, you know, having written the book and more or less got it ready to sort of put it to bed, suddenly COVID happened. And, you know, and it was obvious that COVID was continuing and was a much bigger thing than we'd initially thought it might be. And I felt what I had to do was to go back because everything seemed suddenly so fluid, febrile even. So what I did was to go back and re-interview some of the people that I'd spoken to sort of back in before it was a thing, which is why I was able to sort of go into their houses and go with them to pick up their kids from school and, you know, do all those things, which was great. So I went back. How do they feel now? Very interesting. I mean, on the Labour side, they know that there's a new leader. They like him a lot more than they like Jeremy Corbyn. But they, you know, partly because of COVID, they feel that he hasn't had a chance to sort of strut his stuff. They don't really know what he's about. They want to know what, you know, what gets him out of bed in the morning. And that's, in a way, that's his task. But for Boris Johnson and the Tories, the disappointment was palpable, right? You know, they at the point where I went back to people, which was sort of post-May, Dominic Cummings' trip to Barnard Castle and all of that, they were shaking their heads in disbelief. Some were furious, some were just sad, pissed off, whatever. They felt that he didn't have a grip on things. One person said, which was one of my favourite quotes actually, was, "We voted for bold and we've ended up with waffle." So, you know, just a sense that they thought that he was this clear communicator, we'll get Brexit done, da-da-da-da-da. And then suddenly, whenever he opened his mouth, they didn't understand what he was saying anymore. And it was at a time when they really wanted it to work and to be going well. So, you know, the answer is they're disappointed. But there is also a very strong sense that is this, that, you know, if you have voted Labour all your life and your parents did and your grandparents did, and you've made this absolutely monumental decision to change. And one woman said to me, you know, if my dad knew I'd voted Tory, he would be spinning in his grave. If you've taken that decision, you want it to work out. You're willing it to work out. And especially when there's a pandemic. So you want it to work out anyway, because you want it to be okay. So, you know, disappointing, but in the end, they are still watching and waiting. He still has a chance, I think, to sort of reinvent himself and make it work again.
And do you think it's him? You said he was the magic ingredient, but do you think he's maybe lost some of that power and there's maybe Rishi Sunak or someone else coming up in the wings that they like?
They definitely like Rishi Sunak, but he's a bit of an unknown quantity. And maybe in a way, you know, being cynical about it, it's quite easy to be liked when you're doling out the, you know, the money and you're being the nice guy. I think there's still quite a lot of legs in Boris Johnson, for what it's worth. I think that he's sort of lost his way a bit, but he has the opportunity to sort of turn the ship around, and they're still watching him. He was, in the end, the person that gave them the license to vote Tory. It was him, his persona, his demeanour, he sold them. And I think that, you know, if I was advising the Tories, I would say stick with him.
Interesting. Deborah, thank you so much. Where can people find you if they want to seek you out for further knowledge?
I'm at dmattinson at britainthinks.com. So people can contact me through Britain Thinks. And the book is published by Biteback, so they can contact me through Biteback, the publishers as well. Fantastic. Available in all the bookshops if they happen to be open, or Amazon. Absolutely. Or whatever if they're not.
I come back to, this is just a book that flows so beautifully. I read it in about two sittings. It's so interesting and has so much warmth and heart and depth. So I can highly recommend it to anyone listening. So it's called Beyond the Red Wall. It's available at all good and non-good bookshops. thank you very much for your time today, Deborah.
Oh, thank you, Emma. Lovely to chat.
And just to say thank you to Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme tune. And this has been a Political Human production.